Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
I think we're all searching.
There are some people that think that the media would bias.
It's Wednesday, May 2nd, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Each week we focus on media performance from our seats here at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean, director of the RJI Futures Lab, and here on either side are regular panelists and Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. According to a committee of the British Parliament, Rupert Murdoch is, quote, not fit to run his News Corp media empire. President Obama is playing up the one-year anniversary of Osama bin Laden's death, but social media nearly blew his security cover on the way to Afghanistan. And while an online campaign ad about killing bin Laden has Mitt Romney on the defensive, some wonder whether Navy SEALs may swift boat the president in retaliation. The Federal Communications Commission says large market TV stations have to put their political advertising records online, but there are loopholes. And there's evidence this week that big newspapers, at least some of them, have slowed or reversed the loss of subscribers by putting up paywalls. Let's start with yesterday's news from London that a parliamentary committee looking into the phone hacking scandal has concluded that News Corp chairman Rupert Murdoch is, quote, not a fit person to exercise the stewardship of a major international company. The committee also found that three former executives misled Parliament and covered up the scandal. There's much more detail, of course, in the 121-page report. New York Times media columnist David Carr sums it up this way. News Corporation is a pirate ship, and a new captain is required. Well, Charles, you thought there was another quote from David Carr's column that also was appropriate.
Yeah, Carr wrote a fantastic column in which he basically took the 121 pages down to about 1,000 words, I think. His lead, the British are notoriously fastidious writers, but known more for the prolixity than concision, which I thought was just a brilliant lead. It's a heck of a report from all reports. I haven't gone through 121 pages, nor will I.
Right.
But it's a house in serious arrears, and this committee is miffed, to say the least.
Well, let's focus a little bit on it. Now, this report from the committee is not the same as the criminal investigation that right. Scotland Yard is leading. They haven't filed any charges. The parliamentary committee isn't going to file any charges. In fact, really, assuming the full parliament accepts this report, what can they do besides maybe give the company a slap on the wrist? Still, I wonder, Lee, how bad is this for the fortunes or at least the reputation of News Corp?
I think for the reputation of News Corp's owners, especially the Murdoch clan, this is pretty horrible, and I don't think it's done yet. One of the things that if this were American, okay, I'm going to put that preface in front of it. One of the reasons this report would weed the way that it did is because somebody in Parliament knows that the criminal investigations are going forward and that there are likely to be charges made. And in this case, the Parliament or some of the folks in Parliament are actually trying to get out ahead of that process so that they don't look like a bunch of milquetoast, to use the British phrase, in how they're evaluating this.
Well, let's look at what Rupert Murdoch had to say. He sent an apology memo to the employees of the company, and this is what he wrote, part of what he wrote. We certainly should have acted more quickly and aggressively to uncover wrongdoing. We deeply regret what took place and have taken our share of responsibility for not rectifying the situation sooner. Well, what do you make of that apology, Charles?
My translation of that, nothing to see here, folks. Move along. I think it's wishful thinking. The other thing, this is not the Scotland Yard investigation, nor is it the fit and proper hearing that's taking place around B Sky B, in which Murdoch is trying to buy all of B Sky B, the biggest satellite television provider in the European continent. And this report, while not on that subject, has got to be hanging over that inquiry like a black cloud, I would imagine.
Well, in fact, I mean, you can say from a financial standpoint, at least, News Corp is not really worried as much about the reputation because of the relatively small profits the newspaper division brings in Europe. What they're really worried about is B Sky B. Yeah. They're also worried about what impact any of this could have here in the U.S., where they have some very profitable operations, Fox News, the 20th Century Fox Studios, the Wall Street Journal, Dow Jones Newswire, et cetera. So, Lee, I mean, that really is the problem, isn't it? Whether or not this little scandal in Great Britain becomes a big scandal and a big problem for the stockholders here.
Well, and I think it's not the scandal so much. It's the criminal investigations that are ultimately going to matter, because here, you know, we don't have fit and proper. If we did, we'd all probably be out. But what we do have is the Foreign and Corrupt Practices Act. And that's where what happens in the criminal investigation in Great Britain has serious bearing on what happens here. This Department of Justice has been pretty aggressive about prosecuting this sort of crime, regardless of the organization that is involved in it. The statute itself has real teeth. People actually could spend time in jail, and there are a number of other things that could result from it. The other thing that I noted, and you put it on the blog, Mike, is that Murdoch's apology moves very quickly from, gee, I'm sorry, wish we would have done more, to, don't worry, guys, we're still making money. And I don't think you have to read very deeply into that to see what is actually still foremost in his mind.
Well, and the company and its response, as opposed to Rupert Murdoch's personal response, was also to point out that this was somehow, you know, political, because it was divided in the criticism of Murdoch. It wasn't divided in terms of the overall conclusions,
document, right.
But it was divided about whether he should have been singled out the way he was, with the opposition party basically the Liberal Party being in the Labor Party endorsing the report and the conservatives not endorsing it. Still, I have to wonder, Charles, let's bring it back to the U.S. again, because as Lee points out, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is hanging over News Corp's head. On the other hand, we've seen, you know, really no appetite yet by any American official. Certainly Eric Holder hasn't said much about this. And the last time the FCC chairman was quoted on it, which was granted back in last July, somehow not being quoted on it lately, said, I didn't really see that this was something that was going to affect the licenses of Fox properties. Could that change with this report, or with what the criminal probe shows up?
Well, I think we said the last time we brought up the whole News Corp thing, we're never going to say never ever again when it comes to this stuff. But it seems unlikely. That having been said, in the Scotland Yard investigation, as I've read in British papers, is effectively what they're doing is going through literally millions of emails and just piling through them and letting the chips fall where they may. And who knows what's in there? Now, there was a story in the Times or the Guardian, I can't remember where I saw it, a couple of weeks ago, about the fact that the attorney who has spearheaded most of the hacking litigation has three U.S. plaintiffs now signed up. I haven't seen another peep about that after the initial story. I think I sent you guys the initial story. I went, uh-oh. I haven't seen that shoe drop yet, and that shoe is there. There was a line buried in the report, which Carr brought out, maybe this best summarizes it. We recognize that matters are fluid, and any report of ours may be overtaken by events.
Right. There was, by the way, one sort of a left-leaning public interest group called CRU, which today or yesterday announced that they were calling on the FCC to yank the licenses for all the Fox stations. But we'll see whether that goes anywhere. I did note, Lee, as did you, that at least initially the results of the financial markets has actually been positive. The thought that if the Murdochs have less to do with the running of the company, that this could actually be a good thing. And the stock price ticked up a bit yesterday.
The stock price ticked up, I think, even more today, or at least it did the last time I checked. Since we record before the market closes, I don't want to be caught too much in that. The other thing about this, though, is that this comes at a time when you've got a lot of social media folks who are trying to become involved in a lot of Wall Street things. And so it's not clear to me what's going to happen at the next, say, shareholders meeting. And it's certainly possible to organize negative votes among shareholders in a very different way than it was, say, 20 years ago when people who owned various American companies were trying to figure out how they could pressure them to divest in South Africa, for example. So like Charles, it's one of those goes, never say never, but isn't it interesting the times in which we live?
Well, I think it's safe to say we'll be following this story for months to come. Today, we're going to move on to our next topic. That involves President Obama and his reelection campaign. They've sought this week to capitalize on the one-year anniversary of the death of Osama bin Laden at the hands of American Special Forces. We'll talk in a moment about the online ad the campaign ran this week, but let's begin with the president's trip to Afghanistan. He was there to sign an agreement with that country's president to pledge ongoing assistance after we pull our troops out in 2014. But perhaps more importantly, he was there to celebrate and have TV news show him celebrating the bin Laden anniversary with our troops. So let's talk a little bit about this, Charles. I mean, clearly the conventional wisdom in the past day or so since the surprise visit to Afghanistan has been that this was a home run for President Obama over Mitt Romney, that he demonstrated once again the powers of incumbency, the power of the presidency to command media attention. I mean, I know that's a sort of cynical take, but it's certainly been one of the dominant themes of this.
Sure. I was walking through the Ark last night and saw on one of the big TVs over the exercise bike, President live from Afghanistan. And I went, whoo, bully pulpit, right? I mean, he's using incumbency the way presidents use incumbency. What makes Obama particularly effective at it, I think, is that no matter what he does, no matter how predictable, I mean, this is incredibly predictable. You go to Afghanistan to give a live address while you're running for president as an incumbent. Every U.S. president would do something very similar. What makes him so good at it is no matter what he does, the right goes completely insane as a result, thus doubling the megaphone that he has. I am constantly amazed by that, the fact that they would be outraged by his, militarization of publicity, is coming from a bunch who gave us a guy in a flight suit sitting on an aircraft carrier with mission accomplished behind it.
Well, and in fact, there were some pundits and some media writers who were suggesting that the president needed to be careful that this didn't become his own mission accomplished story, that with all the problems that are constantly occurring in Afghanistan, all the reversals, the Taliban reawakening, that maybe we shouldn't be – he didn't declare victory,
right,
but he certainly said we could see the path to basically destroying al-Qaeda.
I think he did a good job of avoiding that minefield. I agree with Charles. I think there were some people on the Republican side, including at one point Mitt Romney himself, who pretty much stepped in it and then have now sort of tried to figure out, ooh, I don't like where I just wound up. How am I going to get out of this? So, for example, one of the congressional leaders said, well, he shouldn't politicize the death of Osama bin Laden. That's not what American politics is about. I thought, really? From George Washington forward, this is precisely what American politics has been about. If you can't politicize war in the sense of have a discussion about was this worthwhile, was it appropriate, did we do the right thing, then what in the world are we sitting here for?
I wonder whether or not this will be an issue that continues to resonate or if it's just a momentary pop for the president.
I sort of doubt it. I mean, I think it's a one-off, but the pattern that repeats itself over and over again is what I think the Republicans should be concerned about, and that is they've got sort of angry bull red cape syndrome. I mean, anything that comes up, no matter what it is, they charge at it head down 150 miles an hour, big, small, economic, foreign, domestic, military, non-military. It doesn't make any difference. Everything is the same.
There's at least some suggestion that the president maybe doesn't need to worry about the Republicans or the right generally on this issue. But there was some concern expressed, and I've heard some stories about this, that some of the Navy SEALs, for example, and so the special ops community are upset that the president, in their sense, is politicizing what they did, and that some of them may choose, with some financial backing from the right, to swift boat the president on this.
I think that might be a little hard, in part because we've been swift boated once already. So everybody,
but it worked.
It worked, but I think that's why it's going to be tougher, because it's kind of like fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. So I think that in and of itself will be more difficult. The other thing, since the Navy SEALs aren't talking to me and I'm certainly not talking to them, these strike me as fairly intelligent, well-informed people. They knew what they were doing was political. The fact that it had a military aspect to it doesn't change the actual act itself. I think, you know, the more difficult thing for everybody here is, from my point of view, is to be glorifying what is essentially an assassination or a state-sanctioned murder. And I think that's a problem. It's a problem more for our relationships with Afghanistan than it is perhaps for domestic consumption, but it is nonetheless a problem.
Charles, it appears at least there's another interesting media angle to this. An Afghan news station sort of spilled the beans about the president coming there by tweeting this fact, and he might have endangered the life of the president. At least that's what the White House was arguing in trying to get American media not to retweet it, to pull any stories back that they had until he landed and was secure at the airbase. Was that, I mean, one, does that seem like a realistic concern? Did the mainstream media follow the right path in holding off on that information? And I guess the other aspect of that is, can we protect the president in that regard with the social media now being everywhere?
It's a good question. I mean, I think in that case where he's in the air and they tweet it from the Afghan TV station, I think the U.S. media not retweeting that was the responsible thing to do, especially S. Leon Panetta. I mean, he landed there, what, a few months ago? And there was a car bombing literally in his proximity. So, I mean, it's an incredibly dangerous place. And it's not just the president. There's a rather large entourage flying with him, right? So yeah. I did think at that case, while wheels are up, until he gets there and it gets secured, that I mean, when W used to go to Iraq all the time, it was the same sort of operational secrecy around that until he was safe and secure. And then they would always announce the fact that he was there. And I think that's probably the way to go.
Lee, I mean, can we maintain those sort of ethical standards in the wake of the social media? And I mean, somebody is going to find out. Somebody is going to tweet about it or post something on Facebook or whatever. And the temptation, if you're part of the mainstream media, is to grab that, retweet it, saying, not my fault that it got out there.
That is the temptation. But I think even the mainstream media, the legacy media, the dinosaur media, whatever you want to say, has probably figured out the security piece of this puzzle. I also think that there is some minor public relations coup for letting this story be broken by an Afghani journalist. It's their country. He was visiting. So, you know, and I also have to think that the White House, which I think the Bush White House did much the same thing, has said, well, there's got to be a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C, including that wheels will remain up and we will turn around and go visit somebody else until we can get the security on the ground more the way that we want it.
I did think that it was pretty interesting, the New York Post's editor-in-chief, and the Post was one of those that actually did run it early and then withdrew it later after the White House got on. But in an email to the staff, the editor for the New York Post basically said, it's pretty interesting that the White House thinks that the Taliban holed up in their caves or whatever and worrying about our drone strikes is going to read on NewYorkPost.com that the president's there and can act on it. I mean, kind of cynical, kind of humorous.
Well, they don't think the Afghans have smartphones? I mean, where have they been? They're accessing Twitter just like we are, no matter where they are.
In fact, they're probably better at it than I am.
The other half of the president's sort of political 1-2 punch this week came with the release online of a campaign commercial in which Bill Clinton praises Obama for ordering the killing of bin Laden. And then the ad asks whether Mitt Romney would have done the same thing and suggests that the answer is no.
It's not worth moving heaven and earth, spending billions of dollars just trying to catch one person. He was referring to the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. What did he mean by that? Because it's generated a little controversy, given Osama bin Laden's role in killing, 3,000 Americans on 9/11.
He had to decide. And that's what you hire a president to do. You hire the president to make the calls when no one else can do it.
It didn't take long for Republicans and Romney himself to push back, but President Obama wasn't backing down, as ABC News' Jake Tapper reported last night.
Mitt Romney today said of course he would have given the order to go after Osama bin Laden at his Abbottabad compound. Any president would have, he said.
Even Jimmy Carter would have given that order.
But President Obama is determined to make this success a cornerstone of his reelection effort.
I just recommend that everybody take a look at people's previous statements in terms of whether they thought it was appropriate to go into Pakistan and take out bin Laden.
So, Lee, did the president score big points with voters on this, or did he overreach? For example, Arianna Huffington of the Huffington Post called the ad despicable and compared it to the 3 a.m. phone call spot that Hillary Clinton used against Obama in 2008.
She's entitled to her opinion. I don't know what impact this has on voters. I do know what impact not the ad, but Romney's response had on me. And this is one of those places where I thought he just flat out stepped in it. He could have said, well, of course, any president would have done that and let it go. But instead, he adds, even Jimmy Carter would have done that, which is mean-spirited. I mean, it's just, there's no other way to interpret that other than I'm going to, you know, single out a former president and just say something mean about him. I'm back to Charles. You know, it's red flags and bulls, and they don't know when to hush up.
We can agree with your assessment of Romney stepping in it, but I would have to say, Charles, as isn't the case with most of these campaign commercials, really doesn't matter who the candidate is or what the issue is, but this one was more interested in raising the doubt than actually giving any kind of detailed accounting of what Romney actually said and what he meant 4 years ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what we're squaring with now as a public, maybe, and Republicans are having a lot more difficulty with this than others, is the fact that the guy is running for re-election. So he's going to do things like campaign. I think that they've set up a narrative in which the president is supposed to neither govern nor campaign. I think he's just supposed to sit in the White House and crochet or something for the next few months. And that sort of message is going to be said again and again. Now, to your question as to whether this resonates long, it sort of smacks to me of a tempest in a teapot that has very little staying power in the electoral season.
The only thing I'd add is that usually the Republicans are very strong in defense and very strong on commander-in-chief. And if that is in a normal election cycle, we have the economy and that. Obama takes that second thing away from them with this sort of approach. So in that sense, I think it's pretty shrewd.
Well, while we're talking about campaign ads, we should mention that the Federal Communications Commission this week issued an important, if somewhat compromised, ruling. The FCC instructed network-affiliated television stations in the top 50 markets – now, these qualifications are important – to publish online when political ads appear on their air, how much they cost, and whether they refuse to accept any ads from any advertisers in politics. But smaller stations, like those here in mid-Missouri, won't have to put up those records online until 2014. And those stations that do have to report, according to ProPublica at least, don't have to put them up in a common file format and certainly don't have to make those records searchable. So, Charles, those are quite a few caveats there to that ruling.
Yeah, our very own David Herzog and our faculty is working on a project around grabbing this stuff the old-fashioned way manually so that he can figure out what's being spent on what ads in Missouri. And when this ruling came out, we were talking about it. And I said, so how much does this help? And he said, not that much, because the vast majority of the stations in the state will not fall in that top 50. And thus, we still have a whole bunch of stations that say, yes, we do have a public inspection file with our contracts for political advertising. You're welcome to come see it. You can physically copy it. But they have been acting – broadcasters on this one have been acting like – small town county commissions.
Well, let's talk about that from a couple of perspectives. Lee, first of all, they argued that somehow this ruling would make them lose money, not only in having to put the content online, but what they said they worried about was that other non-political advertisers would more easily find out what that lowest common denominator rate is that they are required to give to the politicians, and that that would lead to them being more aggressive in driving down the rates generally for television ads.
They really think everybody doesn't know already? I find that argument incredibly specious. And I want to go back to one thing that Charles said, because if you read down in one of the stories that, Mike, you put on the blog, and I think it's ProPublica has put this plea out. So I hope everybody within the sound of my voice or picking up us up on the internet does this. ProPublica will take the copies of the reports that you get manually. They will upload them. They will make them searchable. So this is one case where users going out and actually doing a little journalism can help everyone.
It's a good idea, and I hope they succeed. But, you know, it's not necessarily that easy to do, as some journalism students from Kent State University discovered. They recently tried to visit four Cincinnati television stations, and three of those stations didn't want to let the students videotape their visits and charge them a really high price for duplicating the records.
Channel 19 was the only station to allow us to document our experience. Channel 3, 5, and 8 felt uncomfortable with us filming this.
We wanted to shoot video of the records in the public file, but three of the four stations refused. To make a copy at FedEx office, it cost 11 cents. The Cleveland stations were almost five times more expensive and were not willing to budge on the price.
Town sheriff or whatever, say more based on that story.
Yeah, I mean, if you took broadcast stations out of the stories and replaced the words broadcast stations with the mayor's office, county commission, whatever, this is exactly that which those of us in the news media lambasted public officials about, this sort of hiding by pricing and making the cost of public information so unbelievably high that we can't make requests, or making these ridiculous arguments like it's going to give away the lowest unit rate. If I want the lowest unit rate, all I have to do is call Claire McCaskill's office and ask what they paid for it. That will take 2 seconds. So they're behaving like the very people who they like to rake over the coals.
Well, we know that TV stations are expecting a huge year financially because of these ads, something along the neighborhoods of $3 billion in campaign advertising. Newspapers, on the other hand, aren't getting that windfall. And as we all know, they've been suffering a lot, Lee, in the past few years because of the decline in readership. Well, there are some new numbers out today. Those are from the Audit Bureau of Circulations. They measure circulation. And what they found is that the audience erosion is slowing down or even reversing at some of the papers. And the common denominator a lot of them had that were doing well, they'd started a paywall. What do we make of that?
I think we make that this is one point in an experiment. It's hopeful. Whether or not it will work only for large papers like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, which has historically charged for online content basically since the get-go, whether it will work for other sort of organizations, I think that's it's too soon for us to jump to any really happy conclusions. On the other hand, to see papers like, for example, the Los Angeles Times, which I gather is starting a paywall or just did in March. The more that happens, the more that experiment continues, we're going to have some better understanding. We've got the same experiment going on here locally. The Columbia Daily Tribune has a paywall. I'm curious to see whether or not their circulation has stopped eroding, and I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, there are readers and there are readers, and it really would be helpful if people do start – some subset starts to pay for the privilege of this content.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the Times now has more digital subscribers than non-digital subscribers.
Yeah.
Well, Charles, before we wrap it up, you had an announcement you wanted to make, wanted to promote an important event coming up.
Yes, tomorrow night, 6 o'clock, Missouri Theater, Deadline and Disaster, a sneak preview screening of a documentary. I've seen it. It's fantastic. A documentary on the work of the Joplin Globe in and after the deadly tornadoes of last year. We're going to have 10 members of the Joplin Globe staff in visiting and watching the film for the first time along with us. We're having a silent auction at 6 to benefit a memorial for Joplin victims. And then the film starts at 7 with a Q&A right after. It's about an hour long, so shortly after 8. And a rooftop party at the Missouri Theater even after that. So it's a big night. We hope you can all make it.
Well, I hope you can. And that's going to be the last comment for this week. If you'd like to share yours or ask a question, make a topic suggestion, you can email us at views@kbia.org, or you can go to the website, mouse over talk shows, and click on Views of the News. You can also find links there to today's program, as well as audio and video. Thanks to our technical team, RJI's Travis McMillan, KBIA's Pat Akers, and student assistant Chelsea Myers. I'm Mike McKean. Join Charles, Lee, and me again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.